And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Okay, we are back. Welcome to Chatter on Books. This is pretty exciting. It's our 39th episode. We gotta do something big for 40, like a cake, whatever. We are coming to you from our favorite undisclosed location. Our bartender is back in town. Jeannie McManus is here. Jamie McIntyre, our favorite alternate. Thanks for being here. Zach Powers is here. Not in Georgia. Not in the Dorian nightmare. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Claude's doing everything important. Nice, Claude. We're going to do a quick phone with David Aldridge, who, God bless him, has gone back out to Nats Park. David was there last night, too. I know we're not supposed to put times on these things, Jamie, but if you were there last night, you should be commended for suffering through that game. So David's there. We're going to do a quick call with him. We got a few randoms. I have a quiz. Whose line is it anyways? Which I'll make very easy. And Zach, I didn't prepare you for this, but you can play too. And we've got Zach, who's going to talk to us about this great book, First Cosmic Velocity. And Zach, I know you couldn't hear us last time we tried to have you on from Georgia. We raved about it.
We right, did. Jamie?
We raved we about did. It. We loved it. David was very sad he couldn't be here because he really loved the book, but we'll talk to you about that. And then in honor of the hoax at the centerpiece of your book, Deserted Island, is going to be our favorite hoaxes. But first of all, Calvert Woodley went to see my favorite pals at Calvert Woodley today. And everyone should go, even if you're not a wine drinker, liquor, cheat, you should go.
Oh, I'm a wine drinker.
I've noticed. The most wonderful staff there who are so knowledgeable. And so we have a lovely wine this evening, which, who's got it? Jamie's drinking. Mm. It is Palazzo Bellatore, which is an Italian. What does it taste like, Jamie? I'll tell you if you're right.
It's, hold on. Mm. It's definitely, I'm loving it, but I'm.
You're going to say lots of cherry and dark spices.
You know, I'm tasting some cherry and some, what was the other one?
Yeah, dark spices.
Dark spices, yes.
Infamous Robert Parker says it's worth twice its price. And then the cheese, it came around from the counter at La Cheeserie saying, Fontina, you have to have this. This is the epitome of good Italian cheese. And I think it's lovely. And I've learned how to cut it properly.
Is there any bad Italian cheese?
I don't know, but they were very excited about this one.
To check out and see how many we can.
Cow's cheese, it's been made since the 13th century or something like that, 12th century. And it's one.
It looks
fresh. It's made in the Alps, and it's from cow cheese, and it's so special and so unique and so wonderful. It gets one of those designations. It's sort of like champagne.
The DOP,
yeah.
Right, like the tomatoes.
Exactly.
And the prosciutto and the
Parma
ham.
Exactly, yeah. We have David. Okay, we are now going to... Hi, David Aldridge, how are you?
I'm sleeping. How are you?
I'm good. I was there till midnight last, David, and you must have been there later. Did you just sleep there?
No, I wrote my column and I went home and I put my head down on the pillow, and about half an hour later, I got a text saying Jay Gruden had been fired.
Yeah. At 5 o'clock in the morning, which is when everyone should be fired.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, we're missing you, but you're really, really nice to do this. And I know it's a little bit early. We're not going to, it's not going to be first pitch for about 45 minutes, an hour from now when we're taping this. What's the vibe in the park? Because the crowd tried to hang in there last night. You saw it. We tried to hang in there. We tried to be good. But how are they feeling now?
Even at 8-2, I was very impressed with how they hung in there. You're exactly right. They did not walk out in droves after that home run. It's, I think, a little more subdued tonight, but I did not get here quite as early as I did yesterday. It's filling in reasonably well. I'm sure they're going to have, if not a sellout, very close to one. But it does, the vibe on the street, if I can say that, seems a little bit more subdued today. But, you know, one win and they're happy again.
Yeah.
So, David, which Max Scherzer is going to show up tonight?
Great question.
question. Any predictions?
Look, it's a guess. My guess is Max is like a lot of great pitchers who will be in the Hall of Fame, like Greg Maddux and others. Max has not been a great playoff pitcher.
Right.
And who knows why that is. I don't know why that is. And my guess is he will not be great in this game. I don't think he will get shelled. I don't think he'll give up 7 runs in 2 1/3 innings. But I have a feeling he will probably give up a few runs. And so the question is, can they score enough off of Rich Hill, who's 40 years old and who hasn't pitched really at all this year because he's been hurt all the time. And can they score enough runs off of him early to be able to stand up if Max gives up two or three runs in five or six innings? And that's the big question.
Well, I guess the other big question is, how could you not start Max Scherzer, given his numbers for the season, given his performance in that eighth inning? I mean, and what other, I mean, you really, this is the guy you have to go with, don't
right.
you agree?
Yes. So that was true for the wild card game.
Yes, absolutely. You have to go with it. Now, I will disagree a little bit. I would have started Strasburg in the wild card game because he's had a better season, frankly, than Max has. And in a one game playoff, you know, when your season on the line, you want the best guy. Now, tonight, because of the way this crazy series has gone, they have no choice but to not only pitch Max Scherzer, but they have to live with whatever he gives them for as long as he can give it to them. So they don't have the luxury of taking him out if he gives up four runs early or something like that, because they don't have an answer. They've got nobody else in the bullpen other than Doolittle and Daniel Hudson. They have to get seven innings out of Scherzer tonight to have any chance to win this game.
Ugh. Okay. Well, we wish them the best, yes. And we wish you the best. So, David, just in case some baseball fans might have some time on their hands in the coming weeks that they might have otherwise been, just in case, what's your favorite all-time baseball book?
I don't know. When I was a kid, I read Bob Uecker's autobiography, that Catcher in the Rye, W-R-Y.
Right.
And it was very funny as he is, but I don't know. I guess it's kind of a cliche, but I was really impressed with Michael Lewis and Moneyball. It's a great book.
Yeah. Pretty iconic.
It's a terrific book about, yeah, I mean, it really did change kind of how everybody views baseball in the modern day era, right?
Yeah.
But it was so well written, as all of his books are, that it made what seemed to be unexplainable explainable and make sense. So it's his gift and his talent that allows that to happen. So it was a wonderful book. And you know, I really, it's one of those books I go back and read over and over again.
Nice. Well, hopefully we won't have too much time for that, but good luck tonight. Stay awake and we'll see you in about 12 hours.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thanks, David.
Bye, David.
Bye.
He must've been there till 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And then struggle home. Jay Gruden at 5 a.m.
5 a.m. I want to know the background.
Okay, I know it's a book show, but call the guy in at 5 a.m. That's just the ultimate.
Yeah.
Rub it in your face.
You know, as a news reporter who over the years has occasionally covered sports and hung out with some of the sports writers, they have it pretty good. I'm just saying.
That is not true.
Oh, yeah.
That is so not true.
Not anymore.
Well, you have never.
Because they're all on 24/7.
Across the parking lot of FedEx Field at 3 in the morning after a Monday night football game.
I know it seems like life and death, but it really isn't.
I'm not talking about the game. I'm talking about the life of a sports writer. Yeah. It is peripatetic.
Listening to Liz Clark talk about her, we think, 12 weeks or whatever it was, 10 weeks in Europe,
right?
World Cup, French Open, and you think, oh, isn't that great? It sounded horrible.
Especially in the World Cup, because she was covering the whole entire country of
she
France.
Lived in 11 different
She'd
places
go
or something
from one
like
side
that.
Of the country. Yeah. To,
well,
yeah,
maybe
yeah,
I'm operating on outdated information because I remember hanging out in Memorial Stadium.
Yeah,
and
dating
in
yourself.
The press box with the free beer and the unlimited crab cakes. And
they
everybody
do eat well.
And all the people rooting for the home team. By the way, at the time, the Washington Post was the only news organization that forced the Orioles to pay, that, so they could pay for their food.
That's right.
All the other people, including WTOP Radio, who I work for, we just took the food for free.
And we paid for our food, and we never drank beer on the job. Never.
God bless you. Well, that's you. The
no,
Royal
no,
we might
that
be.
Is...
You think everybody?
No, the Post didn't.
Totally.
Yeah,
none of us ever did.
Okay. All right. Okay. So from the sublime to the ridiculous, Jeannie and I were talking earlier, yesterday, today, and there's a lot going on in this town right now. And this is about books, and she'll make this about books, but you're going to introduce a topic that we might be talking about for the foreseeable future. God help us.
Well, one of the things that I was compelled to read or reread this week was the Constitution of the United States.
Hands up. When's the last time you've read the Constitution? You've looked at it,
everybody
Zach?
Everybody should go back.
Ever?
I'm sure I took a government class.
Sixth grade, Claude, ever? It's going to be 10 years. 10 years, okay. Yeah,
I have a couple of those pocket constitutions that various people have given me at various times. And
Schmidt. Remember Schmidt?
Yeah.
He used to hand out copies of them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm generally familiar with it.
Okay, Jeannie.
So, well, I was not familiar with it, but ever since I have...
Even though your father, as I learned...
Yeah, my father taught constitutional law at Georgetown. I don't think his politics, this is the thing about constitutional law. There are interpretations, as, you know, Sirica would tell us, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg would tell us. There's all kinds of ways to look at the Constitution. So I just tried to read it as a reader. Now, the preamble.
Did you quibble with how they did it?
No. I mean, the preamble to the Constitution.
Once an editor, always an editor.
Beautifully written.
We can tighten this thing up. We got a couple of extra words here. We can just tighten this.
The Declaration of Independence is beautifully written, uplifting. But the Constitution is a serious legal document. But ever since I've begun to read it, and now I've read it two or three times in the last week, every time I hear somebody say, a Republican or a Democrat, well, the Constitution doesn't allow that, or that, yeah, you can do that according to the Constitution. It's, to me, and again, I'm not a constitutional law expert, to me, it's not obvious that what they're claiming is in the Constitution is actually in the Constitution. So my next step will be to read books about understanding the Constitution. However,
books plural, I'm impressed.
Yes. Those books have avenues that they go down that are not straightforward. There's a conservative book. There's a book that relates it to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There are left-leaning books. So it's interesting to see how this, I mean, this document is almost like the Ten Commandments, you know? I mean, it's very straightforward, but...
The interpretation's not so much.
The interpretations go over the map.
You know what they should do? They should have like a panel of people who are, you know, expert in legal, like maybe 9 people, and then have them like decide what the Constitution means and then issue some sort of guidance so we could understand it. That would be helpful.
You know, people are always saying, well, the founding fathers, well,
they don't really know.
Come on. Yeah.
Okay, but in just in defense of all of us who will not be reading multiple books about the Constitution anytime soon, maybe you could narrow it down to 1 or 2.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, I've got a couple that I'm trying to take the most straightforward path. But what I love is when you buy the Constitution online, as I did on my iPad, the author, Founding Fathers, I'm like, oh,
that's great.
Yeah. And Declaration of Independence. Franklin, Benjamin Franklin. Oh, okay, yeah, I've got a book by Benjamin Franklin now.
Is there an audio version? I'll do the audio version.
There probably is. That'd
be great. Voiced by Franklin, actually.
Recorded.
Yeah.
All right, I've got a couple of randoms, then the quiz. So Ron Charles, who's been on the show. Zach, do you know Ron Charles?
Yes, I know.
He's a fabulous guy. And if you haven't seen one of his latest videos where he's dressed up like a cockroach, you've not been living. But you should subscribe to his newsletter because it's really good and really fun. And just a portion of his newsletter from last week. Is that Orwell in your pocket, or are you just alarmed about the state of the world? John Self, a book critic in Belfast, discovered that the pockets of his new trousers are printed with a text of politics in the English language. Orwell's classic 1946 essay about political rhetoric couldn't be more relevant today, but this feels a bit like printing Edward Munch's The Scream on a beach towel. Self bought the pants for around $120 from a UK clothier called Spoke. The founder and sartorial big brother of Spoke is Ben Farron, who tells me, God bless Ron Charles, finds this guy and talks to him, who tells me that Spoke is, quote, a brand that knows what matters. He explains, great writing matters. So this season we put great writing in the lining of our pants. Only Ron Charles could bring that to you. Okay. And Jamie, you and I were talking before the show. October 7th is the anniversary of?
The first U.S. Incursion into Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks.
Yes, and Cats opened on Broadway in 1982 and then ran for about 18 years, which is about the length of the Afghan War. Okay. All right. Now we're going to do, because Jeannie does try to keep me on the bestsellers list, which I love to hate. But what I'm going to do, and Zach, you have to play. I'm going to read you a line from a book on the bestsellers list. Jamie, did you study?
No.
No, okay.
No, I didn't. Just like in college.
Just shout out answers. Are you feeling a little pressure?
Yeah.
A little antsy? More wine for Jamie. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to read you a line, and you have to guess what book this is from. We have no medical records because we were born at home and have never seen a doctor or nurse. We have no school records because we've never set foot in a classroom. When I am 9, I will be issued a delayed certificate of birth, but at this moment, according to the state of Idaho, that's the giveaway, and the federal government, I do not exist.
Oh, is that Tara Westover?
Bing, 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 bing. Yeah. Go. Did you guys know that?
I did not.
Anybody?
No. I was going to guess Hillbilly Elegy, but that was just, you know, just so I'd have something to say.
We have a very strong opinion about Hillbilly Elegy around here. Okay, next one. And this book really surprised me how much I liked it. The morning burned so August hot, the marsh's moist breath hung the oaks and pines with fog. Zach is thinking about this.
Were the crawdads sing?
Go, Jeannie. Jeannie is crushing.
See?
It pays to read. Have you read either of these books, Jeannie? No. Thank you.
No, I read about them.
It pays to read the New York Review of Books.
Yes, yeah. It does, too.
Okay. At our school, pink was for summer, plum was for fall and winter, white was for special days, Sundays and celebrations. Arms covered, hair covered, skirts down to the knee before you were 5, and no more than 2 inches above the ankle after that, because the urges of men were terrible things, and those urges needed to be curbed.
Boy, that sounds like my grade school. I should know this book, but I don't.
Maybe you did. Anybody? Anybody?
It would have helped if I just perused the bestseller list before I...
Testament by Margaret Atwood.
Oh.
Right? Okay, and then the last one. My considerable blessings in life were now causing a kind of psychic whiplash. I wanted to have a work life and a home life, but with some promise that one would never fully squelch the other. I hoped to be exactly like my own mother and at the same time nothing like her at all. It was an odd and confounding thing to ponder. Could I have everything? Would I have everything? I had no idea.
Is this nonfiction?
That is nonfiction.
Is it Demi Moore?
No.
Oh.
How about that book, though?
Yeah.
Let's get her on the show. Yeah. Whew. Man.
You can't see my eyebrows going up on the radio.
Hint. First lady.
Oh, Michelle Obama?
Yes, Michelle Obama. Wow. Yeah. And I say it all the time on the show, and I think I've said it on Tony's show. I hate political memoirs because they tend to be so carefully, defensively written. Hers is really good. Really, really good. Okay
so Tori, Jeannie got 2 correct answers, and she wins. Tell her what she's won.
Yeah, she wins the voice of any chatter on her home voicemail. I always like that when they do that on Wait, Don't Tell Me, because who has a home answering machine anymore? Exactly.
But I would pick Paula Poundstone.
She's pretty good. She hasn't been on much lately.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Claude, can we take a quick break here, and then we'll come back with All Zach All the Time. Great. We're back at Shatter on Books. We're in our favorite undisclosed location. Bartender's a little absent, though. We slack it on the job.
I hate to tell you this, but I think they voted to unionize, and that could be part of the problem.
So we are very happy to have Zach Powers with us. He was almost with us, was that 6 weeks ago? When did Dorian happen?
I will go with, I've lost all sense of time.
Well, you should have been here because we raved about you. We raved about your book. We talked about how much we loved it, but we're glad you're here in person. Thank you so much. And I love to start things off by asking, and I think we tried to get this question to you, but we might not have been able to hear it. You write about this incredible fraud in the Soviet space program in the 60s, and there seems to be a lot of knowledge about space and astronauts in it. Are you one of these people, because we've had 2 other authors on who wanted to be astronauts and they're young. Did you want to be an astronaut?
I never wanted to be an astronaut. Certainly now I don't want to be because I have really bad motion sickness and I would not survive the ride in the bus to the launch pad, much less the launch itself. But no, my brother is an aerospace engineer and has been since he's 4.5 years older than me. Happy birthday yesterday to him.
Happy birthday.
Growing up, we had space shuttle launches on TV. He skipped school to watch space shuttle launches. He had models of space shuttles. He drew pictures of space shuttles. He had software on the very early computers we had that would track satellites in orbit. So the roots of it were just, it is not that foreign to me of a subject, or I should probably say alien to me, since we're talking space, of a subject. And that's where most of that, the comfort with the subject came a lot from him being being involved in space exploration from the time he was probably like 5, 6, or 7.
So you, but you've written a lot and you covered literature and arts in Savannah, right? Savannah, mm-hmm. Georgia. Did he give you the particular idea for the story? And I'll do the CNN headlines version, Jamie, with all due respect. And it's the Soviet space program in the 60s. And the fraud is, this isn't giving anything away, is they have sets of twins. And one will go up and there's a terrible accident and never come back. But the other one left on Earth pretends to be that one.
And is paraded through.
Trained and paraded
Russia
through
as a
great
hero.
Soviet yeah. propaganda. So where did the idea come from?
Most of my ideas for writing start with something rather small, and I will dare say stupid. So I think the whole idea of
you're
this
in good company.
I'm pretty sure the idea for this, I don't know the exact origins now, but it was probably simply the phrase, ooh, space twins. And I got excited about the idea of space twins. I recall talking to, I was at lunch with an author friend, and I brought this up, and that's the first time I remember saying out loud this idea that became the book. And that was many, many, many years ago, though. So I don't remember the exact origins of that. I do know that it was influenced by the... can you use the phrase real conspiracy theories?
It's getting very confusing.
Yeah, by the conspiracy theories that actually were made by other people about the Soviet space program. And one in particular has always stuck with me was the story of a couple Italian brothers in the version I heard had a radio and picked up transmissions from a cosmonaut stranded in orbit, basically cursing the Soviet Union and the engineers of the Soviet space program because he couldn't come home and he knew it and he was stuck in orbit. And the other thing, I didn't know this until I started researching, though, is that there were lots and lots of secrets and lots of failures that were hidden from the public until the 1980s and even the 90s after the fall of the Soviet Union.
And some we probably still don't know. Watch Chernobyl on Netflix.
Yeah, wow.
If you haven't watched that one. Right? So tell us, First Cosmic Velocity, the title of the book, what is the first cosmic velocity?
The first cosmic velocity is a somewhat dated term, meaning the minimum speed necessary to achieve orbit. It was a term I found in research early, and I typed it in at the top of the manuscript. First thing I typed in the manuscript, and it stayed there from then until it made it on the cover.
Yeah. So one of the things we talked about when you weren't here last time is years and years and years ago, I took a couple graduate courses in Soviet studies. So, of course, I know what I'm talking about. and I'm reading this book, and I'm loving this book, First Cosmic Velocity. And I'm thinking to myself, if I didn't know you and I didn't know you had written this book, I would say this is some classic Soviet dissident writing this book in the late 80s or the 90s. And the sense and the knowledge of what it was like to work in any capacity with the Soviet government at the time is there. How did you learn that?
I mean, that was a lot of research. There were the first comprehensive English language history of the Soviet space program came out. I don't know the exact day, but it was a historian named Asif Siddiqui who wrote what is now two volumes, originally a single large volume history of the Soviet space program. And you can't read that without getting into the Sovietness of that setting. But the other thing I think I actually tried to avoid, trying to do that. I had actually, in my research, I read a story collection. It was a really good story collection set in all Soviet settings. But there was one story where it seemed to really, really try to prove that it was Russian. And and I was realizing, I realized at that point that if you're a Russian living this, you don't notice the things that are particularly Russian. You don't notice every little detail the way that an outside observer would.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, occasionally you have to establish scene, you have to establish setting and use those details. You have to establish the feel of living in post-Stalinist Russia, because there is certainly this overarching fear of that people still had, that the real chief designer of the Soviet space program, Sergei Korolev, who one of my characters is based on, was sent to the Gulag by Stalin. Stalin was sending all the intellectuals to the Gulag, and he was a leading scientist. And he was only pulled out because the Soviets suddenly needed missiles. and he was one of the
leaders.
He was
the guy who could do it. Do you speak or read Russian?
I do not. I had a couple of people I could rely on for questions. My father is no longer a fluent Russian speaker, but at one point was a fluent Russian speaker.
Well, I think he's a spy. Like, wait a minute, guys. Full stop.
The phraseology of the characters, I mean, obviously I don't speak Russian, but seemed not stilted or forced at all. They seemed to be speaking the way I would imagine Russians to be speaking to each other. And again, not like, you know, Boris and Natasha in Rocky the Flying Squirrel. I mean, very, very
realistic.
Yeah, well, it could.
What about Moose and Squirrel? So, just to be clear, is your book about a real conspiracy theory or a fictional conspiracy theory?
This is the great thing about it and why everyone should read this book, Force Cosmic Velocity, because especially if what not, we know it could, now.
It could start a real conspiracy theory, right?
I mean, that would be great. No, this is, I made up the conspiracy theory entirely.
But it's so believable.
There is a little bit, in the history of the space dogs, which were launched up there.
Spectacular. Can you tell those stories?
Of the space
Anything
dogs?
About the dogs,
oh, yeah,
I love,
can,
of course.
Well, you don't want to go too deep into the dog history.
I know, because they don't come back.
Well, there are a lot more that died than were ever revealed and are even really generally publicly known. The records are unsealed now, and you can find this information, but it's not part of the mythology. So everyone knows Laika, who did die in space. They don't usually know that she died much more quickly than was told at the initially. But then there's Bjelke and Strelka are two of my real life heroes. They were the first two creatures to go to space and return. My favorite true story from that, though, is that Strelka had puppies after her launch.
This is amazing.
And Khrushchev gifted one of the puppies to Kennedy as a big old middle finger.
That's right.
And, but anyway, even better though, Strelka's puppy had puppies with Kennedy's dog. So there's a line somewhere out in the world of president space dogs, and I really want to find one. And if you're listening right now, please contact me and I will adopt.
Caroline Kennedy has talked about this and how much they loved that puppy. And then the puppy had intimate relations with their dog, and there you go. But talk about, can you imagine the Soviets sitting around planning that up and Khrushchev saying, here's what we're going to do, and pack this puppy up and send it over there?
Yeah,
it's great.
So I love the space dogs, and at least 90% of the inspiration, or the motivation, I should say, to write the book was to write an alternate history in which Laika did not die in space. She appears in one scene very briefly, just as a nod to two readers, like, oh, she's cool.
Yeah,
she's there. She's fine. She's hanging out in the kennel at the training facility.
So you do know that there are millions of Americans who believe conspiracy theories about our own space program.
Yes.
There's still people debating about whether the moon landing was actually shot on a Hollywood set.
Well, the more I read this book, and I read it twice, and then I thought, this absolutely could have happened.
I read it twice.
I've read it twice. It absolutely could have happened, and that's what really gets you thinking.
And as I was reading it, I thought, it did happen. Zach has very artfully made this seem like fiction, but it's so possible that this was happening.
He looks a little Russian, doesn't
Soviet
he?
Russian.
This is a podcast, but
Zach,
for those of you watching,
I'm a suspicious person. I began to Google you, and there is a paucity of information about you.
Good point.
On the internet, and I thought, okay, this guy was either deep CIA or deep Soviet.
Jeannie, you were it's been a while because you were going to be on a while ago. Same thing. I looked and looked, nothing.
So you know what?
Our dog Russ has more online than you.
I'm not that secret.
So these are the kinds of things that fuels conspiracy theories. But you know why people believe conspiracy theories?
Because there's an element of truth
because
in all of them.
Because they're real conspiracies. And the reason they believe that the government lies about things is because the government lies about things.
Yeah.
No, I don't believe that.
Yeah. Okay, one of the things I loved in the book is that the relationships of some of these people. And in my massive studying of the Soviet Union, one of the things that was incredible, the Soviet Union was at its worst. People's personal relationships were very important because the system was so oppressive, the system was so corrupt, that personal relationships became incredibly important, which there's some hope and some optimism to that. So are you having worked on this book and researched it and written it, I'm increasingly convinced you're a spy. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about human nature?
Oh, wow. I'm optimistic about human nature in a lot of ways. I worry that we're not good with the scope that we have to deal with now, that the human mind can't handle the breadth of the scale of the things we're facing. I mean, if
like
I just want
too many things on Netflix and we don't have
exactly
time
like
that.
I can only binge so many shows at a time.
It's a big problem.
It is
big problem.
So I go back and forth. I can't say that I'm always optimistic or I'm always pessimistic. I believe strong. I don't believe I am an unspiritual person, which helps when you're writing about a forced state
that
atheism.
Comes out in your right. book.
Yeah. But I believe, so I don't believe in meaning with a capital M. I don't believe I believe in our cosmic insignificance. The scale of us in the scale of the universe is so small that it's hard to believe that we mean anything at all. I mean, we're smaller than dust compared mm-hmm. to the universe. However, that's really freeing to me in that then the meaning we create is entirely created within the scale of us. So it's this interpersonal thing. It's between me and another person. It's between me and an art object. It's between me and an idea. So that I love the idea of the fact that we have this incredible lattice work of personal meanings that come up because we're not necessarily questing for some, we're a very small part of the grand design. And that frees us from some sort of obligation of being, we're not the center of the universe. And as much as the last 500 years
some people
years
in
of
this
human
town
history,
might think so.
Well, yeah. Right. Yeah. DC is its own special thing. Yeah.
Yes. Wow. I'm just going to say wow. Yeah. Because it just reminds me of that classic Peanuts cartoon where they're all lying around looking at the clouds and Linus sees like the stoning of St. Stephen's in the clouds and Charlie Brown says, well, I see like a ducky and a bunny. I'm like, wow. Okay. Yeah. That's on another level, but our cosmic insignificance. Yeah. I like it.
Working the word. So I read the book. At the end, I was optimistic, mm-hmm. and I felt better about things. And I thought to myself, I want there to be a sequel. So I don't know if you have one planned, but if you wrote a sequel to First Cosmic Velocity, what would happen?
Oh, my gosh. This is a lot of pressure here. I'd be back to the dogs.
Well, you didn't show up last time, so we had to make this time hard. We would have been much nicer the first time.
About your book.
No, I mean, there is no planned sequel. I mean, I tend to write the ending is open. I can say that without giving too much away.
I agree.
It doesn't contract to a neat point. It sort of expands,
and I like that.
And mm-hmm. and I mean, there are ambiguous things going on throughout the book that are left ambiguous. And so that was intentional. So there are certainly storylines that could be pursued. I mean,
you could just go all dogs.
It could go all dogs.
And what about, I mean, to me, I'm reading this and I've got Anthony Hopkins. I'm casting it. You know, have you had any hints, any nibbles?
It's been the manuscript and novel have been read by a few Hollywood type people. No one has picked up an option yet.
Okay, the people who did Chernobyl, who I'm sure are listening, should do this.
Yeah.
That should be their niche.
There were some great actors in
line.
That.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the character of the chief designer was fascinating to write, but I also feel like I may have wrote what I had to say about him. Uh-huh. So I don't know if I would follow him.
I kind of let people write their own. Mm-hmm. What happens next? Well, it's wonderful. First Cosmic Velocity by Zach Powers. It's absolutely wonderful. We raved about it before. We'll rave about it again. If we were on C-SPAN, we'd be holding up a lot, mm-hmm. which is a sign that we like a book. But it's terrific. And Zach, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break and come back with our Deserted Island segment, which is based on your book. And is that okay, Claude? Take a break. Thanks. All right, we're back. It's Chatter on Books at our favorite non-disclosed location. And in honor of Zach's wonderful book, First Cosmic Velocity, we don't often do this, Zach. Deserted Island usually has nothing to do with anything else. But in honor of your book, which is about this great Soviet hoax, which I think actually took place, we are going to do our favorite literary frauds. And if you just Googled literary frauds, it's pretty amazing how many come up. Jeannie, would you like to go first?
Well, my favorite is Clifford Irving's, quote, autobiography of Howard Hughes, which was really genius because Howard Hughes had been a recluse for about 10 years. So Clifford Irving proposes to his publisher, and Clifford Irving was a guy who'd had a couple of successful novels, and he proposes to his publisher.
Isn't he a lawyer, though? Does he have a legal background?
I don't think so. Okay. That he's got in contact with Howard Hughes.
Of course, they believe
him. The billionaire, you know, notorious Hollywood producer, airplane creator. And he's been in contact with him, and Howard Hughes has agreed to let Clifford Irving write this autobiography. And so Clifford Irving is producing letters from Howard Hughes and receipts for various trips where he's gone to interview Howard Hughes, and everybody's fallen for this hook, line, and sinker.
The backstory seemed to take a lot of work, creating the record of pretending to do these things. Yeah,
and he was in cahoots with another guy named Ron Suskind.
I remember him.
Yeah,
the two of them.
Good voice.
The two of them. There's two Ron Suskinds. Oh. I'm not sure.
I don't remember that one.
This is a children's book author, but anyway.
Oh, take it back.
The two of them made a very credible case that this was Howard Hughes' autobiography. And, of course, that was shrewd because Hughes hadn't talked to anybody in a decade. But all of a sudden, from Hughes' apartment in Las Vegas, where he's like covered everything in plastic because he's a germaphobe, begins to call people and say, this is
not me.
This isn't me. This isn't me. And so finally, the jig is up. And Clifford Irving and his wife, who was depositing his advance checks in a Swiss bank account, are eventually convicted and go to jail. And this is a classic American story. Clifford Irving emerges from jail and writes a book called Hoax about trying to perpetrate.
In the PR business, that's called making lemonade out of lemons.
Hoax, or chicken salad out of chicken livers, as we used to say in sports. And then Richard Gere does a movie about Hoax. So it all kind of works out for Clifford Irving.
Levels of Inception. Yep. Jamie?
So I thought a lot about this because I thought, okay, so for literary hoax, I thought of two criteria. One is that the person who is said to write the book didn't actually write the book, or the person who wrote the book wrote something that they know was just not true. They just made something up and passed it off as true. So thinking about that criteria, I went to my bookshelf and I was looking at things in my book. And the first thing I got to do was the religion section, where I have like the Bible and the Quran L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics. And I said, no, I'm not going there.
This would be a fun segment.
Yeah.
How you arrange your bookshelves. Do you do it by subject?
By sort of general category.
Okay, nice.
I thought, well, I'm not going there. Religion is a very personal thing. I'm not going to go there. And then I got over to some of the books that I kept. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, this book would qualify. It's called The Art of the Deal.
It's
ostensibly by Donald Trump, but it's actually written entirely by Tony Schwartz.
Right.
Not a single word was written by Donald J. Trump. In fact, not only did Donald Trump not write the book, but apparently he didn't read the book either, because during one of the many times he was sued and suing people, in a court deposition, one of the lawyers tried to use a passage from the book against him, and Trump testified
I
never said that. I only read that. I didn't know anything about that.
He doesn't read.
And
half and two-thirds of the information in the book was wrong anyhow.
Well, I have to say, Tony Schwartz did a great job of just sort of synthesizing what Trump might have said if he said it. But, Schwartz said he couldn't, so the idea was he was going to write, he had proposed the book, including the title, The Art of the Deal, to Trump, and Trump thought it was a great idea. And he said, well, so the way we'll do this is I'll interview you. We'll do some interviews, and then I'll take those interviews and I'll turn them into a book. And, a lot of people who write memoirs write them with co-authors or ghostwriters.
They usually acknowledge them, though.
His name is on the book.
Okay.
But what he discovered was he couldn't get Trump to concentrate long enough to do any interviews. So he couldn't get any usable material from interviewing him. So they came up with another plan, which is that Tony Schwartz would follow him around for 6 months and listen in on all of his phone calls and take notes, and then just come up with what he thought Trump might say. And so he came up with the memorable phrase, truthful hyperbole.
Ooh.
To describe when, Trump would say there were 13 more floors in his building than there really were. It's like truthful hyperbole, which now Tony Schwartz says he regrets. But I have to say, after going through all that, I settled on a book that I thought was written by somebody who has to know it's not true. The book is called, it's a response to a book, an excellent book, So, you know, you and I were in the Pentagon on September 11th.
We were.
And there's a whole conspiracy theories that have grown up around September 11th. And Popular Mechanics in 2005 wrote a book, and I'm holding it up here for our audience to see. Can we get a
News
shot
Channel
of this?
8. Yeah, got
it's
it.
It's called Debunking 9/11 Myths. And it is a really good job of going through all the
science. Wow.
And by the way, the foreword is written by the late John McCain.
Oh, nice.
Excellent foreword.
Nice.
So I'm reading this book, and I'm thinking, well, this is great because this really lays out all the facts. Logic, reason, explains why all these conspiracy theories are not true. This will be case closed. But no.
Oh, no.
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 6 months after debunking 9/11, this comes out, comes debunking 9/11 debunking.
Oh, my God.
In which they answer, they have an answer, they answer every one of these with another conspiracy theory. So my nominee
Holy
for
cow.
Literary fiction of a sort is debunking 9/11 debunking. And one of the insidious things about this, by the way, and this is because of the way Amazon works, is if you order this book, debunking 9/11,
people
myths,
who bought that book
people who
also
bought that
buy
book also right. bought this book. So
holy cow!
And the conspiracy theories never end.
Ever. Okay, I thought mine was good. That's so not as mine's no, so not as good. So I all the ones Clifford Irving I thought were great, but I was looking for one that we hadn't really heard about. The Education of Little Tree. Zach, you're a literary guy. Maybe you've heard of this. This one was on Oprah's book list club or whatever for some time. 1976 by a guy named Forrest Carter. And it was about a kid, a Native American, who was orphaned. And so he was raised by his grandparents and very tragic, you know, those kinds of things. Well, it turns out to be Asa Carter, a former George Wallace speechwriter and member of the KKK. But the book went on to great success. And even when his cover was blown and even when Oprah pulled the book off her list because they find it still continued to go on and be quite successful. And speaking of Amazon, if you go into Amazon, the Education of Literature, there's no mention of this. It just talks about the book and the author and how well it did and it achieved notoriety on this list and that list or whatever. It's remarkable how easy it is to get away with fraud. But the favorite is James Frye.
James Frye
on Oprah.
Another
everybody's
Oprah.
Crying. Yeah. And
that
then
was,
she
was too easy
pieces.
Though. That's just a gimme.
Yeah, exactly.
So are we out of time, or can I mention one more book?
You can absolutely mention one.
Okay, so I have a new editor editing my newsletter, and her name is Susan Katz Keating. And she wrote a book back in the 90s called, I'm going to forget the name. It's like Prisoners of Hope, it's
okay.
called. And she was a young reporter, and she came to Washington, and she wanted to get a big scoop. And she latched on to some of the folks who believed in the 1990s that there were still prisoners of war being held in secret camps in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, I'm going to break this story open. And she did a lot of research, and what she figured out, and I think this is actually remarkable because people hold on so tightly to their
sure.
beliefs, is that she figured out that, no, it wasn't true. It really wasn't true. And that people who were perpetuating this sort of conspiracy theory were actually taking advantage of the people.
Kind of a cottage industry for some people.
And so she's a new editor. So, you know, I found out she wrote a book. So, of course, I ordered the book. And when I went on Amazon to order the book, just like you said, people who bought this book also bought a book about how we're still holding prisoners in Vietnam.
Gosh.
So you can just pick your truth. Just pick it. It's up
yeah.
to you.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. This has been great. Zach, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Come back again in person rather than yes. you know, on the phone. That really didn't work. Claude, thank you for making everything work. Jamie, Jeannie, thanks for being with us. We don't want the update from Nats Park.
Yep.
We're hoping when people listen to this podcast tomorrow and days after, they will all be very, very, very happy. Go to Calvert Woodley at 4339 Connecticut Avenue. Say Chatter 5. You get $5 off. And they actually know that now, which is terrific. And come back next week when we are going to have Carrie Callahan. Zach, do you know Carrie Callahan?
Yeah, I did a panel with her. She is fantastic.
Absolutely fantastic. And Jeannie, this book is going to be right up your alley.
I've
it's called A Light of
it.
Her Own. It looks fabulous.
Absolutely.
Historical
have all
fiction.
Kinds of books about the Dutch masters.
We love that artwork. It'll be fabulous. Yeah. Thanks, everybody.